The Roaring Twenties is an era burned into the modern psyche as a time of celebratory excess after a world war and the end of the influenza pandemic.
And with vaccines going out by the millions today, an end to the COVID-19 pandemic is in sight.
But historians are saying now's not the time to break out the champagne and flapper dresses. I'm Adam Toy.
And I'm Dave McIver, and this is Why. Ah, the Roaring Twenties. Champagne flowed and people celebrated like there was no tomorrow.
And no surprise, too. The Western world had reason to celebrate after coming out of the First World War and the 1918 influenza pandemic.
Well, as you say, the end of the last major pandemic, the 1918 influenza pandemic that started probably in the US and killed something like a third of the global population. Infected something like a third of the global population, not killed. That was followed pretty rapidly by, you know, the Roaring Twenties, which, if you think about it in popular imagination, is the period of flappers, jazz dancing, the prohibition in the US, that kind of whole cultural outpouring, but also loads of social and cultural and political transformation. Like, women became increasingly prominent members of society. In lots of places, they gained the vote, etc. Gay culture really flourished in lots of Western cities.
That's Agnes Arnold Forster,
postdoc in the Social Studies of Medicine department at McGill University, and I'm a historian of healthcare and medicine. And primarily, our expertise is in the history of the United Kingdom, but I also work on the history of Canada in the US.
We asked Agnes to join This Is Why to talk about her piece called Will the End of the COVID-19 Pandemic Usher in a Second Roaring Twenties?
And there's been some circulation about whether that will also happen in our own, very own 2020s, whether we'll see a similar kind of return to joy and hedonism. And in my piece, I argue that maybe that's a tad too optimistic, and that although there's plenty of opportunities, or there will be plenty of opportunities for celebration with the kind of easing of lockdown and shelter in place orders, that perhaps we need to be a bit more cautious about what's going to go on in the coming few years, particularly around things like income inequality, gender inequality, and immigration laws.
Now, of course, the Roaring Twenties, the 1920s, that was largely a phenomenon in so-called Western culture in parts of Western Europe and the United States and Canada. Do I have that right?
Yeah, absolutely. It was very much something that circulated as well in big urban centers like New York, Paris, Berlin, London, and those kind of places.
I mean, through all of this conversation, we're going to focus on more those areas rather than the what a pandemic really is, which is a global event. But something that strikes me is that 100 years ago, medicine and medical science was vastly different than what we're facing now. Yet a funny coincidence seems to be the efficacy of masks. I'm wondering if you can tell me how the medical science has changed over the past 100 years in regards to the two pandemics.
Absolutely. I mean, there's plenty of similarities. Like, most of the measures that were put in place to effectively contain the 1918 influenza pandemic were kind of low-tech social measures, like quarantining, asking people to stay away from, closing things like cinemas and shops and theatres, much like they've done over this past year in many places in the world. And masks, as you say, were a key commonality between the two, you know, otherwise chronologically distant periods. And you also saw in 1918 and 1919 lots of opposition to these measures and lots of opposition to things like masks, you know, along very similar lines that we see now, like along lines of kind of individual liberty or civil rights. The big difference is the vaccine, or the presence of vaccines. And that's not because there weren't any vaccines back in 1918. There was the smallpox vaccine, which was effective and later went on to kind of eradicate smallpox globally. But there wasn't a flu vaccine. And for most of the 1918 influenza pandemic, doctors were working under the misapprehension that it was a bacterial disease rather than a viral one. And so they were kind of even going down a bit of the wrong path in order to look for an effective vaccine. Now, obviously, we have multiple highly effective vaccines. And this has, you know, not only been like an opportunity for real joy, but also a real opportunity for real optimism going forward, that this might be the thing that brings the pandemic to an abrupt close.
So Agnes, the 1918 influenza pandemic infected about a third of the Earth's population, as you say, but a century ago, that virus targeted a different population. How does that virus compare with COVID-19 in terms of who were hit the hardest?
Well, as we all know, the COVID vaccine has been a particular problem for older people. Obviously, it has been incredibly, it has affected people from all different age groups, and especially people with underlying health conditions or disabilities. So I don't want to discount that kind of those sorts of effects. But the thing that's unusual or that was particular about the 1918 influenza pandemic was that it was very much a disease that primarily affected the young. So people in their 20s and 30s were much more likely to die from that disease than people of older generations. And so that was particularly harrowing for communities, for global communities, partly because it came, you know, hot on the heels of World War One, which had also, you know, decimated the particularly young men who had died on the front lines in various different places in the world. And so it had a different age profile to the disease that we are now living with. And so that's probably a very distinct something that really draws them apart.
And you mentioned polio earlier. Polio also really hit the very young and had long-lasting effects that were very visible. But it's my understanding with COVID-19, even if there are long-lasting effects, they're not necessarily as visible as, say, a polio infection. I've got that right?
Well, polio definitely caused lifelong disabilities and sometimes very visible effects on the children who survived the disease. I mean, the thing with COVID is there's so much we don't know about what's going to happen with people who have been afflicted with what we are currently terming long COVID. And I think the science hasn't really caught up with precisely what that's going to look like for those people. But yeah, there's definitely true that COVID, that polio had very sort of visible and easily recognizable after effects.
So if COVID is affecting older people and you know, polio and the influenza pandemic are affecting younger parts of the population, and is, as you said, it that was right after a large swath of the younger population was killed in the First World War. Do you think that there's a difference in the societal reaction because of those different age ranges that are being most directly affected?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm a historian as well as medicine and healthcare of emotions. And it's really difficult to get an insight into past people's internal lives. But I don't think it's unreasonable to speculate that if you had survived World War One, you were a young person, you'd also survived the influenza pandemic, which was, you know, posed a very immediate threat to your life. You then might feel a real palpable and immediate sense of relief, and you could channel that relief into the kind of fun and hedonism, going to bars, going to parties, going to dances, that kind of really characterized the roaring 20s the first time around. Today, and again, not to discount any of the very real physical and emotional and mental health consequences of the coronavirus pandemic on young people, it might not have quite the same impact on the way they feel coming out of the pandemic. And it might not cause quite the same sort of palpable, tangible, immediate relief that we saw, you know, that could have been channeled into that new social life that we saw back then.
Tell me more about this marked shift in kind of the social dynamic, social norms. You mentioned the flourishing of gay culture. It was also a high time for jazz and for nightclubs. And I think also cinema was also coming up during this era. Tell me more about what happened in the, you know, immediately following the 1918 flu through the 1920s. And maybe draw the connection, you did a little bit earlier, but draw the connection between tell me about all of those different things as possible effects from the influenza pandemic.
Absolutely. I mean, the thing about the sort of roaring 20s was that it was really seen as a kind of breakpoint from older Victorian cultures. And I mean Victorian in a kind of a loose sense, right, in a kind of cultural sense. Obviously, Queen Victoria herself had died, you know, 20 years prior. But there was still this sort of hangover of kind of what was acceptable in public life, what was acceptable in terms of the clothes you wore and the kinds of cultural products you consumed. assumed. It's also a massive like technological sort of transformational, sort of slow transformation. Historians are very reluctant to talk about kind of like easy and quick changes in the past, but broadly speaking, it's fair to say that, you know, as you acknowledge, something like cinema, transport, communication technologies were really on the up in this period. And also you see sort of big cultural shifts and big social shifts. And one of the main ones is that the 1920s was supposed to see an expansion of women's role in society and an expansion of women's rights, particularly in terms of electoral rights or democratic rights, but also an expansion of female participation in the workplace. And this was partly a product of of the influenza pandemic, because, as I said, this had really decimated young people, and particularly because it traveled with soldiers who were returning home from the front line. It was also very much a male disease, and this is borne out in the demographics of the death rate certificates from the 1918-1919 influenza pandemic, that this very much killed young men. And this had a kind of tragic, this sort of opened up a kind of tragic opportunity for women to take on roles in traditionally male industries, like even things like construction and factory work, but also in traditionally male professions like medicine and law. And you see a massive increase in women qualifying as doctors, for example, in this period. And so it is this sort of like, you know, despite all that tragedy, it did provide a kind of shakeup of the social order that allowed previously marginalized people to play a bigger role in social and political life. You definitely saw in the 1920s an uptick in disposable income, particularly for those who were already at the upper ends of kind of the socioeconomic order. And we know this partly because they spent more money on all those kinds of cultural products that we were talking about before, like going to the cinema, alcohol, clothes, that kind of stuff. But the 1920s also saw a increasingly widening gulf between the rich and the poor, and an increased economic inequality. And this is the thing that people often don't think about when they think of the 1920s. They see all the glitz and the glamour, but they don't see the sort of exacerbated poverty that some people becoming richer, you know, within capitalism almost inevitably produces. And this is also, I suppose, one of the interesting things, and perhaps both a parallel but also a point of difference between then and now, is that while today you have seen some people manage to retain their wealth or even, you know, increase their wealth over the course of the last year. I'm thinking particularly of like Jeff Bezos, who's become even more of a billionaire over the course of the last, 12 to 14 months. But whereas for most people, or for many people, COVID has had a dramatically deleterious impact on their income and on their financial solvency. And this is particularly true for young people who have really struggled to stay in work and are unlikely to be able to bounce back really quickly, particularly because they don't tend to have as many assets as their wealthier older generations. Like, they don't own homes, which seem to continue to be, you know, increasing in value. But if you don't have one, then it's even harder to get onto that property ladder, for example. And, you know, as I said in the article, having fun, having the kind of fun that we think about when we think of the Roaring Twenties, that costs money, and it particularly costs money for young people. And so if we are thinking that the future might hold that kind of, you know, form of celebration, that kind of outpouring of joy and expression, we're not going to see that without some serious rethink about how we distribute money in our economies, particularly in our economies in the global north. And we've seen this, you know, throughout US, Canada, Britain, Europe. The young have been the worst hit by this pandemic, and I think it's very unlikely that they're going to be able to be flashed in the cash in the next couple of years.
The stratification of wealth, the growing divide between rich and poor during the 20s, is really interesting. Tell me about another parallel you mentioned in your piece, an increase in nativist sentiment that ended up creating the U.S. Immigration Act of 1924 and Canada's Chinese Immigration Act of 1923. Are we seeing parallel sentiments today?
So the thing about the 1920s is that we think of this as this period of like liberalism, equality, and expanding opportunities. But simultaneously, it was also a period that saw a kind of sharp restriction on freedom of movement across borders. And as you say, various countries implemented anti-immigration legislation. And they implemented anti-immigration legislation that specifically targeted people from Asian countries. As you mentioned, the Chinese Immigration Act is one example, but also from other parts of South and East Asia. And we're seeing very similar things happening today. Partly it's in the increase of like anti-Asian sentiment, particularly around kind of characterizations of COVID as the Chinese virus, the sort of racist formulation that this is a, alien import in some way. And we can see that in kind of like that's having real life ramifications for like harassment and abuse targeted at Asian people or people of Asian descent living in places like Britain, the US and Canada. But we're also seeing, and as you pointed out, a kind of hardening of national borders, increasingly restrictive immigration policies, and as you say, a sort of increasingly nativistic or sort of nationalistic approach to public health. And this is a very, in some ways, predictable for historians of medicine response to pandemics. Diseases often provoke, we think of diseases as being real kind of provokers or promoters of massive social change, which they are, but they can also entrench inequalities and exacerbate problems that were already existing, but have now given been given sort of new cause to be entrenched in law. And this, I think, is one of the most troubling and I think kind of negative outcomes of this pandemic. And we can see this also in the way that, for instance, the vaccine has been distributed globally. Countries pursuing incredibly, self-interested policies when it comes to patenting and the sharing of their kind of vaccine supply. The story in India at the moment is unfolding in like a kind of particularly tragic way. And we know that there are some countries that have, it seems, kind of in some ways patently unfair that there are, I know in Quebec, for example, they're rolling out next month the vaccine to people in their 20s and 30s. Mm-hmm. But there are still places in some parts of the world where you can't get a vaccine, even if you're in your 70s or 80s.
Right.
And these are inequalities that, they weren't created by the COVID-19 pandemic, right? There's always been these like massive inequalities between the global north and the global south. This shouldn't come as a surprise to us, but it is demoralizing, I think, to see how the this pandemic, despite, the ample amount of evidence at our disposal and the ample amount of historical precedent that we could draw from or learn from, that we seem to be following very similar trajectories as we go forward. I just moved from the UK to Canada and in a very, very small way saw the difficulties that are imposed by the pandemic and how difficult it is to move across borders at the moment. And for me, this has been a relatively, I don't want to overstate the sort of challenges that I've faced, but I do think it's important to recognize that we do live in an incredibly globalized world, right? Like everybody has now, pretty much everybody has family, loved ones, work, opportunities, whatever, in countries other than the one they're in. And the pandemic has, in some ways necessarily, but also I think in other ways not necessarily, really restricted our freedom of movement. And I think that's kind of very troubling potential for the future.
So if you were saying earlier that it seems to be that we're trending towards making some of the same mistakes that happened in the 1920s, especially with regards to potentially putting in legislation that would restrict or that would entrench, I guess would be a better word, to anti-Asian sentiment. How can we avoid that? How can we avoid making the mistakes of yesterday?
The problem with being a historian is that you really build a career out of pointing out other people's mistakes rather than having to actually provide meaningful solutions to those problems, which, is a real professional flaw, which I completely take on board. But I would say that we need to keep social justice at the core of any future policy plans. And that might mean making decisions that are perhaps unpopular or thinking more creatively about how we can work around some of the challenges imposed by COVID-19. I think we do have to have international movement of people, free international movement of people as much as is possible, and hopefully to a greater extent than we had before COVID-19 even, as a priority as we move forward, rather than as a sort of like something we are willing to sacrifice. Because I think that will have really negative consequences, not only for, people's lives and happiness and well-being and, employment opportunities, but also for the way that we view other nations and other, these sorts of anti-immigrant immigration policies have had historically knock-on effects on how people conceptualize other races. You know, they exacerbate xenophobia, sort of very kind of hardened and negative and punitive ideas about sort of national identity and patriotism. And so I think that needs to be really a priority going forward, that we think very carefully about what we can retain. I also think we need to be very, very seriously about how we are going to ensure that the vaccine is available globally. This pandemic will not be over until it is over for everybody. You know, and you see loads of these sorts of optimistic and joyous articles, including maybe my own, I'm adding to that problem, coming out of like lots of places like Britain and Canada talking about the end of the pandemic. You know, the pandemic is far from over. It just depends on where you're placed in the world as to what your perspective is on how soon that ending is.
This Is Why is produced by me, Adam Toy, and Dave McIver. It's a national radio show and a podcast.
You can reach us by email at thisiswhy@globalnews.ca and on Twitter at thisiswhy.
If you like what you hear and want to hear more, make sure you subscribe to This Is Why so you never miss an episode. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And if you like what you're hearing, tell a friend.
Thanks for listening. Wash your hands, wear a mask, and get vaccinated if you can. We'll see you soon.
Hi, it's Shauna, and I might be a bad parent because my kids think french fries are vegetables.
Hey, it's Ryan, and I might be a bad parent because I went out for wings when my wife was in the hospital after giving birth.
Johnny here. I might be a bad parent because in my house, the tooth fairy gives pocket change.
But we're not alone. Len emailed us and said his six-year-old daughter's Tarzan moment going from love seat to lazy boy by curtains made him more proud than any dance recital.
And Andy left his two-year-old at the rink.
All right, guys, I'm sure we're not alone, like Andy's kid.
For stories and confessions like this, make sure you check out our podcast.
It's called Bad Parents, and it's available wherever you get your podcasts.
I left a glove at the rink.